We get things underway this afternoon, though, by welcoming to the program an acclaimed music journalist, the author of a number of books like Feel Like Going Home, Last Train to Memphis, Careless Love, Sweet Soul Music, and his newest, which is entitled Looking to Get Lost, Adventures in Music and Writing. We are pleased to welcome to the show Peter Guralnick.
Hey, Rich. Good to hear you.
I have enjoyed your writing for many, many years, and I saw a comment you made that you're not a critic, you're a fan, and I was wondering, how has that approach informed your writing through the years?
Well, my intention was always to advocate for the music that I loved and for the musicians that I loved, and that's really been my single-minded approach from the time I first started writing. I mean, from the time I started writing about blues singers like Skip James, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, up to the present time when I think the latest thing that's in my in this new book, Looking to Get Lost, is the profile of Dick Curlis. And same intent, same purpose.
And the title, and you refer to it in the beginning of the book, that everyone you've written about was lifted up on the wings of imagination and served to get lost in their art, in the music, in that creation.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I think for me, the music that's mattered the most to me is music which, as Sam Phillips, the founder of Sun Records, and you know who discovered Elvis and Howlin' Wolf and a million others, but he always said it was music from the gut. And it's just music that communicates directly, and music that, in a sense, people who are making the music and people who are listening to the music get lost in. So whether it's Howlin' Wolf or it's Merle Haggard, it's the same message, essentially. It's to be so transported by the music that you lose track of your surroundings. You may drive by your exit on the highway. You know, there's no telling what will happen, but you'll be gone.
And if there's a through line for the essays that are in this book, it's in their respect for their peers and their, I guess, ignoring any sense of genre or boundaries, what you refer to as them being democratic.
Yeah, I mean, this was something, in a sense, that was almost not a retrospective judgment at all, but as I put this anthology together, as I rewrote it again and again, and as I selected who, in my mind, would go with whom. I mean, it's not a collection of all my stuff by any means, or even most of it. And these were people, this is almost like a gathering of friends, a gathering of old friends, some of them newer friends. But what I became aware of was the extent to which, two things really, the extent to which every one of the people I wrote about, no matter how they might be perceived by the world outside, no matter what their shambling exterior might occasionally be, some of them shambled, many of them didn't, but that they all possessed the work ethic. They all just dedicated themselves to their work and worked hard at it. Even someone like Jerry Lee Lewis, who is often just summarized by the casual listener, or, you know, he's such a great performer that people might say, oh, he's just a natural. But he worked so hard to get where he was, and he worked so hard to put on the performance that he does. And the other thing that became, you know, more and more clear to me, it's always been clear to me, but it became more so in writing this book, was the extent to which all of them are driven by a kind of democratic vision. And I'm not in any way talking about politics here. I've never gone into politics with people, and I'm not going to explore their politics or make judgments on their politics. But in terms of the music, none of the artists that I've written about have ever seen categories, have ever seen boundaries. All of them have seen the wide open field of music, the wide open world of music. And so whether you get somebody like Merle Haggard, who is as drawn to the blues as he is to country music, or you get someone like Howlin' Wolf, who celebrates the music of Jimmy Rogers, as so many of the blues singers do, but puts on, I mean, there is no more pure an African-American blues singer than Howlin' Wolf. There's no more distinctive a blues singer. And yet he would speak with wonder about the inspiration of Jimmy Rogers and about meeting Jimmy Rogers when he was a young kid. Jimmy Rogers, the father of country music, as I'm sure all of your listeners know, but Jimmy Rogers showing him, Jimmy Rogers was known as the Blue Yodeler, and he showed this 13 or 14-year-old kid, Chester Arthur Burnett, who became Howlin' Wolf, he showed him how he did his yodel, and Wolf says, that's where I got my howl from. And Wolf was also an advocate, for example, for the music of Elvis Presley, because he said, you know, people shouldn't be making fun of him. He did it his way, and he had the talent, and he took it as far as he could, and he simply none of the artists that I've written about or been drawn to have ever seen those distinctions either of race or of class. They just listen to the music with their eyes wide open, with their ears wide open.
We'll come back to Jerry Lee Lewis a little bit later, but I want to really start as we talk about some of the individuals, about the remarkable chapter, and it's the longest chapter in the book, and it's so powerful, and for me, because I knew him, but also because his story is so remarkable, and that's our son of Maine, Dick Curless, and as I told you in an email, what I would have given to have been just a bystander in the recording of that final album Dick did, produced by your son Jake.
Well, you know, the thing is, it was a revelation to me. I mean, I had seen and heard Dick Curless over the years. I had met him through Sleepy LaBeef at one point when they were both playing at Allen's Truck Stop, where Sleepy sort of had a residence of several years after his bus blew up on the Maine Turnpike. So he was kind of stranded at Allen's. But I had met Dick, but I had never had a sense of the breadth or the depth of his talent or his commitment until he sent Jake a demo tape for an album that he wanted to do. And Jake put the session together, and I begged to be able to write the liner notes for him. And I was there, and it was one of the most inspiring things I've ever seen, I've ever participated in, because of Dick Curless's. I mean, I would say he's as great an artist as I've ever written about. You know, whether you're talking about Elvis or Charlie Rich or Sam Cooke, Dick Curless at his height reached that level of achievement and that level of inspiration. But the session was just so astonishing. Dick was quite ill. I mean, he didn't realize how ill he was, and we certainly didn't. He died 4 or 5 months later. But he mesmerized the musicians, great musicians who were playing with him. Duke Levine on guitar, and Mudcat Ward on bass, and Billy Conway on drums. And he mesmerized them to the point where they would lose their place in the song, because they would be so moved. They would be so drawn in by the emotion and by the power of Dick's voice, by what he put into it, not by any show, Dick had an amazing baritone. He would use it sort of for trick purposes on his hits and in his early recordings. But here, everything was put to a specific purpose, and to the purpose of getting the most, wringing the most emotion out of every song he recorded.
And you mentioned that he was ill at the time, and as you write in the book, he would take breaks after songs and just go lie down for a while to rest up, and then would come back, and the magic would continue.
Well, yeah, I mean, this was at Longview Farm in North Brookfield, where Dick had given his first performance at the age of 17, I think, you know, in whatever it was, 45 years earlier. But he would rest in between songs. I mean, somebody compared it to Jimmy Rogers' last sessions, but I wouldn't go that far. But he would also tell stories, and he would draw all the musicians in, and his entire life, his entire musical experience became the canvas on which he painted this album. And it was an amazing thing. I think anybody who listened to the album, which is called Traveling Through, it's on the Rounder label, anybody who listened to it could not fail to be moved by it. But man, I wish everybody could have been like you. I could have just been a fly on the wall witnessing this session, because it wasn't just about the music. It was about a philosophy of life. It was about approaching art in a way that demanded honesty. It demanded that you tell the true story. I mean, Dick was born again in 76. It was the turning point in his life after a very difficult period of alcoholism and just simply being unable to adjust after he came back from the Korean War in 1954. But he was born again, but he never set aside the truth that he was trying to convey in his music and in his songs. And he was insistent that these were songs of living and learning. These were songs, you know, of learning and growing, and that you couldn't turn aside from the cold, hard facts of life. But life wasn't just all, you know, hunky-dory and ice cream cones and, you know, white picket fences and red roses. It was hard sometimes, and the music had to reflect that. And one of the things that was most difficult for me in writing the profile of Dick, which is the longest profile I've ever written and the longest profile I'll ever write. I mean, it's almost like a real-life novella. that's what it was intended. But one of the most difficult things was that he had really given me the charge that he expected me to tell the truth. He went over all of the details of his life, the ups and downs, and there were a lot of downs. And in a way, the story was not the story that I expected to write, which, you know, I would have loved to have written this lyrical story about a guy who achieved great triumphs, which he did, and whose music was able to lift up, you know, anybody listening to it. But it had so many downsides, and it was difficult. And I found it hard. It was quite emotional. And the thing that forced me to carry on was thinking of Dick's philosophy and Dick's words to me that you've got to tell the truth now. And I did my best to tell it. I mean, I hope it, you know, lived up to what he would have wanted. And I'd like to think he would have, you know, he would have approved or he would have liked it. But it was something that I felt compelled to write. And it took me almost, well, it took me over 20 years before I finally wrote it. And it was only when I began this book, Looking to Get Lost, that I finally started to write the full story. I'd written liner notes that were sort of a nucleus of the description of the session. But I never had a place. I always knew I was going to write this story. It was always in my mind. But I knew there was, I couldn't sell it to anybody. There was nobody who was going to publish a story of that length and, or that was that down in a sense. And so when I started writing this book, I thought this is the centerpiece of the book. And that's when I finally wrote the story.
And you can't tell the story of Dick Curlis in full without telling the story of his wife, Pauline, and his family. And she, well, she endured so much. There were times when she thought about walking it away from it all, but ultimately they stuck together. Did they find peace in those final years, Peter?
Well, Pauline said the last years were the best years of their lives, but I wouldn't want to speak. You know, she was so generous, Dick's wife, Pauline, in telling the truth, which has had to have been extremely difficult for her. And I do think, you know, as she described it, the last years they were out there in their Suburban, driving from gig to gig. They were all their own best company. They, their son, Ricky, you know, had built a sort of living space in the back of the Suburban. So they were always, no matter how many clothes and no matter how many guitars were piled up in the back, there was always room to get into bed there. And Pauline described it. They were doing something that was important to them. Dick was finally doing the thing that he was meant to do after many years of sort of being deflected in various ways from it. So yeah, they were. And but you should also mention Dick's daughter Terry. Ricky and I never knew. I met him, but I never really knew him. And I'm sorry I didn't. But I'm sorry I haven't. But Terry was such an incredible help all the way through, and so dedicated to unearthing every single detail and memory that she could, and talking about the play, the house where they had rented in Nashville. She and her husband Bill Chinnick went down there ahead of Dick, as did Rick, and and then Dick and Pauline followed, and they all lived in this house. A retired army colonel, maybe, and Dick, because of his charm, just became fast friends with this army colonel and went to visit him in Michigan. I mean, he and Pauline did. And so, but Terry, just like her father, was dedicated to unearthing the truth.
The last lengthy conversation I had with Dick, and we talked a lot about his career and life, and there was certainly, at that time, still some bitterness about his relationship with Buck Owens. Did he resolve that toward the end of his life?
I don't think so, no. I mean, he didn't talk to me about it a lot. I mean, this is a difficult thing. You never want to pursue something. Everybody's had disappointing experiences. Everybody you talk to, whether it's a blues singer or a country singer, will tell you the story about how they were done bad by their record company, for example. And I know it's true. It's not that it isn't true, but I feel like it's not something that you necessarily want to pursue, because in a sense it's the same story. With Buck Owens, what I think hurt Dick the most was that he didn't give up everything. He saw this as his great opportunity. It was his great opportunity. Mm. Buck took him out on the All-American Tour. They played Carnegie Hall, they played the Hollywood Bowl. And I'm not going to say that Dick idolized Buck Owens, but he really looked up to him as a friend and as a mentor and as somebody he could lose to in chess over and over and over again. but what the inevitable, the downfall of the whole relationship is the downfall of so many things in business. I think Dan Penn maybe, or somebody said it to me, it was a difference. No, Chip's moment said it was a difference over a decimal point. Well, in Buck Owens' case, he was both manager, he was employer, he was manager, he was song publisher, it was as if he were triple dipping into every aspect of Dick's income and of all the artists, not just Dick. I mean, right. This is just the way his business was set up. He had a strong mind for business, and he and his manager Jack McFadden set it up so that basically it was almost like it was like working in the coal mine or something. You owed your life to this company store, and everybody ended up in debt in this system. And it was sort of an instructional difference. Dick never pointed this out to me, but it was one that I drew. One of the greatest experiences that Dick had in touring and working with Buck Owens was Merle Haggard was starting out his career at the same time and working touring with Buck Owens. And Dick and Merle hit it off. Merle gave Dick two of his best songs. Dick described a time in Alaska right after Merle Haggard married Bonnie Owens, who had previously been married to Buck. And a time when they were all sitting around in a motel room up in Alaska and drinking from a bottle and singing Jimmy Rogers songs all night long. Now, the parallel that I drew was that Merle had, and anybody who knows Merle, I think, will have seen this, and it's not intended negatively, but he had a decidedly ornery and negative side to himself. Merle was not really an assertive person in a certain way, but he just was not the kind of person to go along. And in that way, he rescued himself from the kind of fate that befell Dick. Dick, on the other hand, was the kind of person who would go around. This is what his wife Pauline talked about a lot. He put his faith in other people. And that inability to be sufficiently ornery just to go his own way and to be making records that sounded more like Buck Owens or generic Bakersfield records, great records, great musicians, but not Dick Curlis records, gave him just all kinds of he just was frustrated. He felt like he couldn't find his identity with Buck. And then when he had either his house attached or his car attached or something, and they had this disagreement over who owed whom money, that was the end.
We're talking with Peter Guralnick here on Downtown about his wonderful new book, Looking to Get Lost, Adventures in Music and Writing. I could read an entire book that was just your travels with Solomon Burke. What a wonderful adventure that was.
Oh, I mean, Solomon was the most amazing, person. I mean, he and Sam Phillips, I've often said, are the two most charismatic people I've ever met and two of the most eloquent people. I mean, Solomon was just an astonishing talent. And I'll never forget the first time I saw him at the Summer Shower of Stars at Donnelly Theater in 1964, where he was headlining a Soul Review, which had Joe Tex and Otis Redding on it, too. And he just was so charismatic. I mean, there was no question. Today, everybody says Otis Redding. There was no question of who took the show whenever Solomon was on stage. And from the time I met him in 1980 until he died, it was just one of the most remarkable experiences I've ever had in my life. And I've said that, you could do a full-length movie about Solomon if you spent a day with him. And being with him, it was as if he were operating a three-ring circus, except that doesn't do justice. He was, what are the number of balls that he had in the air? I mean, he just was an amazingly inventive, amazingly funny, but deep-feeling person. And one of the things I try to explore in the new book is the complexity of the relationship with Solomon, who was, I've never had more fun with anybody in my life. I've never enjoyed anybody more. But it wasn't all, this is a stupid expression, beer and Skittles with him. I mean, there were difficult times sometimes. There were strains. And the last three times that I saw Solomon, and again, you can't manufacture things like this, and you'd be very dishonest if you did. But the last three times I saw him, he burst into tears with a kind of show of emotion that I think many people whom he, you know, just saw him as this jolly guy who was so funny. He was funnier than any comedian I've ever heard or ever met anyway. And he, but he was, he felt things so deeply. And the last time, or one of the last times, I lost track of which is which, but no, I guess it was the last time. And I was talking to him about, I had given him my book, my biography of Sam Cooke. And he, and the next time I saw him, he says, Pete, you know, it's great, but when are we going to do the book? I mean, I don't know how much he read. I'm sure he read the parts that he was in, but I don't know. Maybe he read the whole book. But he says, when are we going to do the book? And the book, of course, is the book about him. And I tried so hard to do it. And one of the things that I tried to do was to get him to talk into a tape recorder, to talk to his daughter, Victoria, who was, of all of his kids, was the most like him. She looked like him. She had a sense of humor. And they were very, very close. And I said, you know, it just don't try to tell the whole story. Let's just focus on one little, you know, era, one little moment. And then you can send me the tape. I'll work on it. We can see, you know, if you're happy with it, we can try a few things like that, and we can send it out and try to get, you know, see if any, try to get some interest. And I said, how about if you talked about when he was a Wonder Boy preacher, when you were 7, 8, 9, and he was preaching in Philadelphia? He says, what about when I was 10? Well, okay, when you're 10, why did something happen when you were 10? He said, that's when they put me out on the street. And you know, this really kind of took me back. And I said, well, okay, well, why did they put you out on the street? And he says, you know, I've been trying to figure that out all my life. Wow. And then I said, well, who put you out on the street? And he says, I don't know. I don't know. And he just started crying. Now, I think I do know at this point. I think I understand. I mean, he didn't want to say the whole story, and I'm not going to go into it now. But you know, it was just such a powerful thing. And, you know, you try to reassure somebody. I mean, I tried this in a couple of instances to, you know, say, you know, you say to somebody who's suffered a loss, and you say, look, the person who died, they'll always be with you. And they look at you like, what are you talking about? They're gone. You know, and that was the way he was in this situation. And it was just an amazing moment. But he was just an incredible person. And I really tried to put his whole life and my relationship with him over a long period of time into a perspective that I'd never addressed before.
Well, it was very powerful. I also loved meeting a different Colonel Tom Parker than the black or white character that we have been led to believe he actually was for many years. And I love the little dance that the two of you were engaged in for many years, trying to get him to open up a little bit more about his story.
Well, I had so much fun with Colonel Parker. I mean, I feel that this is a serious miscarriage of justice, the way in which Colonel Parker has been understood. And one thing that I think should be understood from the start is that when he met Elvis, he was the superstar. Elvis was not a star. Elvis was a star in the Mid-South. He had sold a certain number of records. But for Elvis, Colonel Parker, and this is Elvis at 19 years old, 20 years old, for Elvis, the Colonel was his ticket to a world stage that he had in mind from the time he first started. He may not have been able to envision it, but that's what he wanted to reach. And Colonel had managed Eddie Arnold to a level of stardom that nobody since has ever achieved. Maybe Garth Brooks came close, but Eddie Arnold dominated country music, and it was through the Colonel's belief, first of all, in Eddie Arnold's talent, just as he believed in Elvis's, and through the inventiveness of his, what he called exploitation, which is basically promotion, and the drive that he put into it. And he revolutionized the music business, first with Eddie Arnold and then with Elvis. Mm. I think that in that sense. But as a person, he possessed so much wit and so much humor, not like Solomon Burke. Nobody was like Solomon Burke. I had the opportunity when I was working on Careless Love, the second volume of my Elvis biography. I had the opportunity to go through all of the Colonel's papers, which Elvis Presley Enterprises had bought. They were in a warehouse near Graceland. I had the opportunity to go through all of his papers, you couldn't go through all of them. I mean, I saw the correspondence. I saw the ways in which he addressed the business problems or the the doing a movie contract or setting up Elvis's first movie deals or all these different things. And the way in which he wrote to Elvis, which was just brilliant when Elvis was in Germany and was just totally down.
Right.
The Colonel wrote him letters, which were just masterpieces of construction in terms of trying to lift his spirits. Colonel couldn't go to visit him in, he couldn't go see him in Germany because Colonel was not a U.S. citizen. He was a an illegal immigrant from Holland. Now, why he married a U.S. citizen and he was friendly with people like Lyndon Johnson, so why he was never a naturalized citizen, I don't know, but he wasn't and he couldn't. But these letters were just astonishing. But in my relationship with Colonel, I had met him. I went down to Memphis when I first started my Elvis biography, which the first volume was Last Train. And I went down there in the January of 88. I went to Memphis because Colonel was speaking at the Elvis birthday celebration. And I figured, well, I'll never get to meet him, but this will be my chance to absorb his aura. So, and then I was sitting with Sam Phillips, whom I'd known for quite some time at that point, about 10 years. And Sam said, you know, I think I'll go over to see Tom, because he would never call Colonel.
Right.
He ain't no damn Colonel. And so I went out, I just trailed along behind, you know, like a great journalist. I, you know, just followed in Sam's shadow, and he introduced me to Colonel. And then I, in the immediate aftermath of that, I wrote a letter to Colonel and told him I was just starting on a biography of Elvis and just wrote a letter and heard back from him immediately. You know, with a letter that started friend Peter and ended as your friend Colonel. And then it would be printed out underneath Colonel, which was his signature. The Colonel was his title. So, and then, but then he invited me to his 80th birthday party in June of 89. And so I went to it. I mean, I was thrilled to go to it. I was unable. I could just go out for the night and come back from Las Vegas. I had to be back early the next day. That's a whole other story. But after the party was over, and it was over pretty early because Colonel went to bed pretty early because I think he woke up at about 4 in the morning. But he was sitting in this throne-like chair with a carved elephant sculpture behind him. He loved elephants. He loved the circus. He worked in the circus. And so I went up to him. He and Sam Phillips were talking. They were arguing, just hammering tongs about the exact order of events in November, or the beginning of November of 1955, when they were working out the sale of Elvis's contract to RCA. And they were just in total disagreement, each of them in total command of every detail and agreeing on everything except the point of it all. But in any case, I go up to Colonel and I say, you know, hi, I'm Peter Guralnick, and, you know, I just wanted to thank you for inviting me to your party. And he says, I put you on the list, in this kind of guttural accent, which people took to be Southern for years, but was actually Dutch. He says, I put you on the list. And I thought, oh, you know, he's kind of not understanding what I'm saying. So I said, no, thanks so much. I really appreciated you. He says, I put you on the list. Well, the third time he said, I put you on the list, it suddenly occurred to me, he was telling me something that I should have understood at the beginning, that he, by inviting me, by having me out there, he was giving me the opportunity. He put me on a list. He gave me the opportunity to meet all these people who were central to Elvis's life and who were, you know, who otherwise might never have spoken to me. And I took advantage of that. And I wrote, I didn't tell anybody at the party. It was a party. So I didn't tell anybody I was working on a book, but I wrote to them immediately afterwards. People like the Aberbacks, who ran Elvis's publishing company, people who were involved in running the Elvis tours, Tom Hewlett, who ran the Elvis tours in the 70s. And I wrote to them, said, well, I met you at the party and stuff like that. And they saw me, where I think they never would have. And they saw me because Colonel had put me on the list. But the correspondence with him, which I talk about quite a bit in the chapter in the book, is it's like playing, you know, I watched The Queen's Gambit recently. That's about my greatest exposure to chess. But corresponding with Colonel was like, you know, it's as if you were playing a chess match with a chess master. And while you might be thinking two or three moves ahead, he was 12 moves ahead. And whatever I would throw things at him, and whatever I threw at him would just come back at me within a day or two, and it just completely turned around and completely trouncing me in any intent that I had. But always he would say, "I wish I could help you, Peter, but you know, I'm not a dirt farmer, and all these people, all they want is dirt. And besides that, you know, you can't imagine the number of people who've approached me. And if I told you these things, they would all be mad at me. So I just can't do it. I'm sorry, I can't help you." And then he would help me. So it was great. It was just, and, you know, so I stayed in touch with him for, you know, until the end of his life. I mean, I went to his 85th birthday and we stayed in touch, and I went to Las Vegas and visited with him. And yeah, I'm not claiming a great closeness, but it was a wonderful and illuminating experience and revealed a side of Colonel's personality. You don't have to know anything about Colonel's personality to give him credit for what he did for Elvis. And in fact, if you saw some of the letters he wrote to Elvis at the beginning of his career, upbraiding him for his behavior on stage, this is in 1955, and saying, "I'm not going to represent you if you act like that anymore, because as important as it is to me to represent your talent, I'm not going to, you know, tolerate that kind of thing." But when Elvis signed with RCA, he sent Colonel a telegram, which is as close to a letter, I think, as Elvis ever came. And he sent him a telegram saying, "You're like a father to me. I love you like a father." And it was true. And it may have been like so many. It was a marriage that, it was a youthful marriage for Elvis. And maybe after 10 years, it was a marriage that ran out of steam. A lot of marriages do. But it meant everything to Elvis for those first 10 years.
I found the chapter on Doc Pomus to be so inspiring. He was such a larger-than-life character, but the fact that he continued to write and create literally until the end of his life, I thought just made his story so powerful.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's funny. I was thinking about this the other day, and I was thinking how I wish that I could have written a chapter on Dick Curlis that had that same feeling as the chapter on Doc Pomus, because the chapter on Doc, you know, it's so up and it's so entrancing. And it's not that Doc's life, I mean, he contracted polio when he was 6 years old or 8 years old, I forget which. And, you know, he was in a wheelchair for most of his life. Or, I mean, he was on crutches first and then the wheelchair at the end of his life. But, and I don't mean to slight Dick Curlis in any way. I mean, he meant as much to me as Doc. But it was a much harder story to tell. But with Doc was just, Doc's daughter Sharon did a documentary on him. She was there at the inception. She didn't end up directing it, but she brought in all the people. And it's called AKA Doc Pomus. It's the best music documentary, one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. But one of the things about it is that I knew most of the people because I'd known Doc again for a very long time. I mean, these are people, all of them, you know, Doc Pomus, Solomon Burke, Dick Curlis, to whom I was drawn not initially by their music, but then also as Charlie Rich. But in this documentary, I knew most of the people. And, you know, I hate to say this because, you know, I'd like to say I'm the kind of guy who likes everybody, but I wasn't hopefully fond of some of the people in it anyway. I mean, there isn't a single person in this movie about Doc Pomus, that doesn't come across as a person that I would like to have as my best friend. I mean, no matter what I knew about them before, and that's how Doc inspired people, how he lifted people up in a sense. But his creativity, I mean, here's a guy who wrote Save the Last Dance for Me, he wrote Little Sister, he wrote Mess of Blues, I mean, he wrote... what's the Dion song?
Teenager in Love, right?
Yeah. And, you know, all these songs that are just roll off the tongue and are familiar to anybody who knows this kind of music. But there he was at the end of his life. I mean, quit music for 10 years, quit songwriting because he just didn't see any future. And it was a combination of things, and he didn't think any of this was going to last. And then he came back, and he collaborated with Mink DeVille. He wrote with Bob Dylan for a while, which nothing really came of that. But this is what high regard he was held in. But here he was in his 60s writing songs that were cut down from the kind of songs that he wrote from Save the Last Dance for Me. This is not to take anything away from Save the Last Dance for Me, but they were cut down. They were much more direct, I guess, emotionally direct. And that right up until the day he died, literally, he was right in the hospital with Dr. John, Mac Revenack. They were working on songs for a Johnny Adams album. It came out as a tribute to Doc Pomus. It was the songs of Doc Pomus, which is just a great, great, I think it's called Imitation of Life, but I could be wrong, but it's on Rounder. But he was working on songs and writing right up until the very end. And that's all very well if you're writing lousy songs. It's still admirable that you stick with it. But he wasn't writing lousy songs. He was writing the greatest songs he ever wrote in his life. I think with the most direct emotional pull, and with a kind of dedication, a clear-eyed view. I mean, in the book, I've got a picture photographed by his daughter Sharon, and you look at him. This is on his deathbed, really. I went to see him in the hospital. I mean, I wasn't there the day the picture was taken, but I went to see him in the hospital and he was dying. Sharon took this picture, and if you look at it, it's just this clear-eyed gaze that you just feel like he sees everything. And that's the way you felt. He was a great company, wonderful person to be around, but he just was, I don't know, he called me up. I mean, he called me up after he'd read, I think, Lost Highway in 79. And he said, "Did you really write this?" I was running a camp, boys' camp on Lake Winnipesaukee, which I ran for 22 years. And he called me up at camp, and he said, "Did you write this?" I said, "Yeah." And we just started talking about what it meant to him and this and that. And we've got to get together. And we got together in the fall, and we were friends forevermore and still are, even if he's not around.
The book is called Looking to Get Lost, Adventures in Music and Writing. It is just a wonderful celebration of music and the incredible people who created it through the years. Peter, thank you so much for making some time for us today. I love the book so much and so great. And thanks from all of us here in Maine for spreading the word about our Dick Curlis. But everything in this book is so captivating. And I've been enjoying your work since that very first book. And it's wonderful to finally catch up with you here.
Well, it's great to be on your show. And thanks so much. I really enjoyed it. And it's great to be talking about Dick, and not just about Dick Curlis, but about the Maine country music tradition in Maine. People should understand that none of this music is the claim of any one place. I mean, Nashville may be the industrial center of country music, but that has nothing to do with where country music grew up. And it grew up just as much in Maine and in, Indiana and Ohio, where Lonnie Mack grew up, and all over the country, wherever their people grew up in the country and heard the call of this music. And it has meant so much to people and will continue to mean so much to people.
Absolutely. Peter, thank you so much.
Thanks. I really enjoyed it.
Peter Goralnik, the great chapter on Curlis, but also in there he talks about people old Maine music fans will remember Hal Lone Pine, Betty Cody, the great Lenny Bro. And it's just a wonderful read. Looking to Get Lost, Adventures in Music and Writing from Peter Goralnik.